I'm Greg Johnson.
And I'm John Morgan.
I'm Michael Polignano.
Welcome back to another Countercurrents Radio weekly show. I'm going to begin today by thanking a number of people for donations. We are cranking our 2017 fundraiser up, and we've had 23 donations since our last update, which was put out a week ago. So I just want to run through these and thank everybody for them. The first was for $256.28 from somebody who is entirely anonymous. Thank you. I think you probably know who you are. Another was for $66.88, again, a completely anonymous donation. We received $100 from Hunt, $40 from Offworld, $100 from Bjorn, $120 from Irwin, $50 from Bill, $20 a month from Leto, $5 a month from Non, $20 a month from Ref, $10 a month from Daniel, $10 from Alice, $4 a month from Skipper, $2 a month from Roger, $20 a month from Chris, $20 a month from Kevin, $300 a month from Lee. That's very, very generous. $6 a month from Irwin, $50 a month from Chip, $50 from Vaughn, $500 from Kathleen. Again, very generous. Thank you very much. $4.88 from Donar, and $200 a month from Emil. So that comes up to $2,045.04, and some of those donations, of course, are going to recur indefinitely after that. So this is a huge, huge help to us, especially in battling our way back from the loss of our PayPal account, which eliminated all of our monthly donations. And we are a bit more than half the way back in terms of dollar amount with those monthly donations. But I don't think we even have a third of the actual number of donors that have signed back up again. The reason for the discrepancy is that the high dollar people signed up right away, whereas the people who are giving smaller donations, I think some of them felt maybe it didn't make that much difference, but enough of them felt that maybe their donations weren't making a difference. And so it has made a difference. So we're trying to get everybody who did a monthly donation to sign back up. And also, because some of those people will never reach probably, we would like new people to come forward as monthly donors to pick up the slack. So thank you all for this. This is very, very good. We are now almost 75% of the way to our $60,000 goal for this year. So thank you very much.
Yes, thanks a lot, everybody. It's really appreciated. And really good for morale as well, I would have to say, to know that people are standing by us.
I concur. Thank you, everyone.
Well, great. So let's talk about what's so far the biggest movie of the season. I think just in terms, not so much in terms of box office, but in terms of discussion. And that is Blade Runner 2049. So both of you guys have seen it. I've seen it. I've written a review of it. There's been a lot of discussion. So people know what I think. So what do you guys think? Do you want to go first, John?
Yeah, actually, Greg, I waited to read your review until after I'd seen the film myself, but I pretty much agreed with your assessment. I mean, I liked it quite a bit, I have to say. I went and saw it twice, and I think the last time I saw a film twice in the theater was Interstellar 3 years ago, so that's a pretty high bar. But that being said, I mean, inevitably, of course, you're going to compare it to the original, and it's nowhere near as good as the original. I mean, I didn't think that there were really many new ideas presented in the film, that it was basically rehashing all the ideas from the original. They did get the aesthetics of the original down very well, I thought. I thought the look of the film was probably its highlight. I also agreed with what you wrote in your review, Greg, that I almost felt like the inclusion of Harrison Ford was almost a drawback, because I felt like the movie had been a lot more interesting before that. And then when he came into it, it started to feel more like just a sequel.
Right. And they started coasting on nostalgia a lot from that point.
Right. And it also reminded me a little too much of his role in the last Star Wars. I've already forgotten the name of it, but
yeah, The Force Awakens, The Farce Awakens. The Farce and Gorges, as somebody called it in a review.
I mean, yes. It's kind of the same thing where you know, he's been missing for decades and then suddenly makes his comeback and he's, you know, kind of this grizzled old guy. And yeah, I don't know. It did, that part of it didn't completely work for me. And I agree with you that I think Ryan Gosling, who I like quite a bit as an actor, was much more interesting in the film. And I would have liked to have, you know, just continued with him. But, you know, if it reminded me a lot of when 2010 came out in the 80s. It's a good film as long as you don't compare it to the original. And that's kind of how I felt about this one. It was a very solid science fiction film as long as you didn't try to put it alongside the original Blade Runner. But, you know, I thought it was very good overall. And there were some scenes that were very good, but I felt like towards the end, they really wanted to go for the level of emotional impact that the original had. Like for me, the climactic sequence with the fight between Batty and Deckard and the famous Tears and Rain monologue. I mean, for me, that's one of the greatest moments in cinema. And I felt like at the end of Blade Runner 2049, they were going for something like that. I mean, they even reused the Tears and Rain music from the original, but they never really got there in my view. So, yeah, I did like the film, but I'd still have to say, for something that's truly groundbreaking, I would have to say it, the original is definitely unsurpassed.
Right, right. So, Mike, what were your impressions?
I really thought that it was visually impressive. I thought that they recreated the environment from the original Blade Runner really well, or at least the post-apocalyptic dystopian quality of it. I thought that Harrison Ford, the Deckard character, even in the original Blade Runner, he was less interesting than Batty, I thought, who really provided a little bit more of character development.
Well, Batty's the, you know, in the fine noir tradition, and also from things like Paradise Lost, he's actually the hero, but you don't really realize that till the end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why didn't they get Rutger Hauer back somehow? That would have been far better, frankly. And of course, it's sci-fi, so they could poof him back into existence somehow, or he could have been the original that Roy Batty was cloned from, or something like that. It would have been, I think, far better, far more compelling to see him on the screen again. And I think it would have forced them to do a much more interesting script, too.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, with that said, with the Blade Runner 2049, what I got out of the movie, I could really identify with the Kay character and just the sense of alienation and profound distance from the world that he's surrounded in, the world that exists with humanity's decadence and the interactions that he has. He's very taciturn and reserved, being a replicant, but he does form this connection with this AI character, Joy, who is just a computer program, basically, which I think is reflective of the modern state of our porn-obsessed internet culture. And I think the movie created that sense of alienation pretty well.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I mean, I think every young white man who sees this movie is going to respond to Ryan Gosling's character, is going to identify with Ryan Gosling's character. And what kind of world does he live in? Well, he lives in this tiny little apartment in this hive of multicultural scum, basically. All these people shrieking in multiple languages and glaring at him as he goes back to his tiny little box. And who does he have waiting for him at home? Not a family, but basically a video game, right? This AI hologram female who cooks him a dinner like a 50s housewife would, right? So
yeah,
we have this horrible world that takes away everything that's real and wholesome and nice and then sells it back to us as a simulacrum. You know, that's just how reality sucks. I remember one time I was watching a TV commercial for some kind of cereal and they had all these people in this wheat field and there was a farm and they looked like Amish and it was all very wholesome and they were sitting down at this whole long table, to eat cereal in a field. And I just wanted to break the TV because I thought, you know, this is a microcosm of what modernity has done. It's taken everything wholesome and real, family life, connection to the earth, destroyed it, and then sold it back to us as nostalgia, as a simulacrum on TV, so we buy their processed junk, right? It's just so beautifully encapsulates, I think, everything that alienates young white men, and especially much younger people than me who grew up in a world of video games and things like that. I didn't. I think I said once that I watched somebody play Pac-Man for 5 minutes and then got bored and went and read a book. That's my entire experience with the video game world. But there are people who live in virtual reality and fantasy worlds now. People younger than me who are totally alienated. And this character K really represents that, I think, very well. And this has just been intensified, and the virtual experiences have become much more, you know, 3D and realistic and so forth. But it's the same escapism from an utterly alienating, multicultural hell world. And so I think that's very powerful.
I've got to believe that the name K, I mean, that sounds very much like a reference to Kafka, you know, Joseph K. in The Trial.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And I think the character is very well realized. I think Gosling is a tremendously sensitive actor. He's supposed to play somebody who's not quite human, but very, very sensitive and wants to be human, wants to be a real boy. And I think he's comes off as far more human than a lot of the actual human characters in the thing, which is just one of the ironies that the movie, I think, beautifully exploits.
Which it takes from the original, because that's
more human than human. That's their motto, right?
Yeah, and in the original, that's, of course, you know, what ends up being true is that part of the reversal of realizing it's not just that Batty is the hero and Deckard's sort of the postmodern man, but it's also that Deckard has actually become more human than Deckard has.
Or Batty is.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
Is it made clear in the original Blade Runner that Deckard is a replicant, or is
no.
that left?
No, and I was very glad that they left that unresolved, because Ridley Scott has come out a number of times since the original came out and said that, as far as he was concerned, Deckard is a replicant.
Which I think is just a horrible cheat.
I agree, yeah, because it destroys the whole meaning of the film.
Yeah, and it's not in the film, and it's not canonical, therefore, and I don't care what the director said. He doesn't know what he's talking about in this particular case.
I agree, but I was really worried that in this one they would use it as an excuse to make that explicit, but they didn't, and that's to their credit, you know, because there's that one scene where, what is the billionaire's, the tycoon's name again?
Wallace, Niander Wallace.
Right, yeah, that he says to Deckard, oh, do you think it's just a coincidence that you met Rachel? Obviously, that was all planned by Tyrell, and then I think Deckard just says something like, I know what's real. So it kind of leaves it ambiguous again, which I really appreciated.
Yeah, I appreciated that too.
Mm-hmm. I saw the replicant revolt, the emerging consciousness and the realization of K that replicants have a soul and have a right to exist independently and can reproduce on their own, as being sort of the emergence, sort of a revolt against the modern world of decadence and decay and Nietzschean, in a sense.
Absolutely.
I didn't see it as this Marxist revolt of the underman. I saw it as quite the opposite, as the emergence of a higher being.
Yeah, I can see that. And one thing I liked about it, too, that was very, well, it certainly didn't fit into any kind of Marxoid left-wing reading, is the assumption that one of the things that makes you human is if you can bear children. Right. Because what the replicants are is really, they're just slaves, right? They're human beings, but they've been dehumanized in some way or another so they can be made into slaves. And if that fails, right, if your dehumanization fails, if one of the things that makes them not fully human, namely they can't reproduce, has been somehow overcome, then they become fully human. And the thing that was interesting to me about Wallace is that he wanted to make them fully human in that sense. He wanted them to be able to reproduce.
But wasn't that just so he could... That was something in the film that didn't quite make sense to me, was apparently they were making replicants, but they weren't making enough, so they needed more to be able to expand to more planets.
Something like that, yeah.
It didn't make a whole lot of sense to me, but
it didn't make a whole lot of sense. And a lot of
I think that he didn't like that he had to actually invest time and energy into the creation process for each replicant, and that if he could get them to reproduce on their own, then he could create this self-replicating class of slaves that would go out and do all the work.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's what that scene where he stabs that woman, or the replicant rather, that falls out of the artificial womb.
Yeah, and why did he do that exactly? Just to show that he's evil or something. I didn't find that made any sense. It didn't make a damn bit of sense to me. There were things about his character that didn't make any sense. There were certain plot holes near the end, too. It's like, okay, so he's trying to get a hold of the child, right? Why? So he can figure out how they were born? Well, he's shown that he can recreate Rachel, and he's got Deckard, so he's got the parents. Why does he need the child?
Well, Rachel, remember, he gets the eye color wrong, so apparently he can't reproduce her. He can make something that looks like her, but isn't.
Well, maybe he was just being sarcastic or ornery when he said that. I took that as not necessarily a factual statement, but...
Well, he also has the bones, which has the genetic code in it, of Rachel, I mean.
Yeah.
So I was like, why couldn't he just sequence it from, but okay. I don't know. I guess it's one of those things you just have to kind of.
I don't think bone actually has the complete genetic DNA in it. You know, it has like little bits of it, but not the entire thing. I think actually the blackout they were talking about was done by the replicants to hide their discovery of how to reproduce on their own back under the Tyrell Corporation.
Well, but wasn't Rachel the only one, at least as of 2049, the only replicant that had been able to do that?
Yeah, I believe so. And they think of her as a miracle baby. And they want to reveal her to the world to show the world that they're human. I guess that's the idea. I don't know just how effective that particular scheme is going to be. The whole thing about the miracle child, of course, is biblical.
Right.
And the attempt to kill the miracle child, of course, is biblical too. It's the Herod's massacre of the innocents, right? And this is what Kay's mission becomes, is to track down the child and kill it. Then he starts thinking that he is the child. And that is, I thought, a really interesting plot twist.
Yes.
I guess we can, you know, do spoilers at this point for people. And we'll put in the show notes that spoiler alert, spoiler alert. For me, what was most moving about this film is Kay coming to think that he was special, that he was born of a mother and a father, not just a created entity. When he finds that this memory that he has, which he thought was just implanted in him, is actually of something real. Namely, he finds the horse in the hiding place in some factory in San Diego. He comes to think that he's special, and that makes him want to resist and to rebel and to make a better world. Then he discovers that, no, the only reason why he has that memory is that the person who engineered his memories was using her own memories as the material and implanting it in her and in his head, and that she is actually the true miracle child. And you find out she's introduced at the end. You discover her identity at the end. But the thing is that when Kay is told that, no, he's not the child, he goes from having a personal reason to fight to continuing the fight for impersonal reasons, for detached reasons, because it's the right thing to do, not just because of his personal connection to it or his sense of personal election or whatever. And I thought that was that's a very powerful psychological, moral transition that very few people go through in their lives, right? For most people, everything's about themselves. They never achieve a kind of detached, dutiful attitude towards things. And that transformation, I think, was taking place there. And that, I thought, should have been really the center of the third act of the film after he comes back from Las Vegas. And I think that would have made it far more, I think, dramatically powerful if they could have foregrounded that. At the end of Blade Runner, the first movie, there's a really interesting transformation, which I talk about in my review of the movie at Countercurrents, which is a similar thing. It's a transition from a personal to a universalist attitude, if you will. And I won't say universalist, I'll just say a detached attitude. Because Roy Batty, you know, he's filled with rage for his own dying life, right? His ending life. And yet at the very end, he saves Deckard's life because as his own life is fading away, he comes to value life in general. So it goes from a personal motivation to a motivation that is impersonal and, if you will, universal, detached, based on compassion. And I thought there was a similar transformation going on with Kay in this movie, and I wish more had been made of that. I think it could have, if it was properly dramatized, could have been as powerful as the end of the first movie, and that would have really launched it into the stratosphere in terms of sequels, because very few sequels are better than the original.
That's true.
The only sequel that I think is better than the original, if you want to call it a sequel, is with the Dark Knight trilogy. I think those movies just keep getting better and better. But generally, when you get a classic movie and then people think, oh, well, we'll do a sequel, they're generally not better. I guess another example of a better sequel than the original is The Empire Strikes Back. I think that was better than the original Star Wars. But it seldom ever happens. Yeah. I can think of two. I can't think of two more. So.
Well, I felt like I was discussing the film recently with a guy I met at a cafe, and he was telling me that, well, yeah, the original never made any sense to me because, you know, it's all about slavery, and he said, who cares about that anymore? So I had to explain to him that, well, that's more of a symbol, like Mike hit on it earlier, because it's also present in 2049. Is it's not, it's more of a Nietzschean revolt. I always saw slavery as more an allegory for sort of this condition of postmodern man. So like in the original, when Batty says, quite an experience to live in fear, that's what it is to be a slave. And then he lifts Deckard up physically, you know, when he's dangling off the edge of that building. You know, I see it as a very Nietzschean moment that it's like, he's forcing Deckard to realize, you know, his position in this horrible, rootless, empty, nihilistic, postmodern hellscape, and saying, you know, you can overcome this, you can transcend it like I have. And I think it wasn't as powerful in 2049, but that's clearly the same sort of revolt that they're, you know, the idea that they're playing with. It's more than just an allegory for the importance of human rights or whatever. It's
right.
You know, it's more about freedom and self-development.
Right.
Yeah, it's tying it to biological reproduction too.
Was, yes.
Something that was important. And the I think 2049 actually did a really good job of examining the relationship between the sexes and how much decayed it is in postmodernity and so far our way it's gotten from its natural purpose, which is reproduction. You know, in today's world, postmodernity is trying to eliminate sex, more or less. It's saying that men and women are basically the same. You know, we can just have environmental differences, and we're not bound to anything really biological. And where the transhumanists are excited about the possibility in the future of growing humans in artificial wombs and just liberating mankind entirely from sexual reproduction and just having sex be for pleasure and also gender being irrelevant. And I think that this is very subversive of that. I mean, it's very traditional in the sense that it gets back to reproduction and a more healthier relationship between the sexes.
Yeah, it is interesting. You're right. The whole creation of artificial wombs and things like that really is, in a way, a consequence of the breakdown of sex. And the breakdown of sex specifically as something connected with reproduction. Once you have birth control and abortion, people can just become consumers of sexual experiences without any connection with reproduction. And what that does is that, you know, basically just fossilizes people into adolescent selfishness and immaturity. Because one of the things that makes people mature, I'm convinced, is having kids. People don't mature unless they have to. And one of the great necessities that galvanizes people into actually maturing is when they have a life depending on them. And therefore, they can't be totally self-centered anymore. And, you know, without that, I think what happens is people just stay crippled and self-centered and lonely.
Well, and sort of perpetual adolescence, which
exactly.
With Blade Runner 2049 is just sort of the logical extension of what we have now, you could say.
Yeah. And so what happens when you don't have, of course, when you have sex as just a consumer experience for selfish people, you don't have reproduction. Populations collapse. And so you need some artificial way of populating the world. And so one of the things that we do now is we import brown people, right, to do jobs that we supposedly won't do, when the real job that people in Western societies won't do is grow the fuck up and have kids. That's the job that we won't do. And so people who are less caught up in modern consumerism and therefore have not suffered the same pancaking fertility rates are simply imported because we're not doing the most important job of all, which is actually reproducing our race. So, and of course, all three of us haven't done that yet. So, you know, I'm not moralizing from on high by any means.
Well, it's at least speaking for myself. I mean, it's not a choice that I've made. It just hasn't happened yet, but, you know, I'm still young enough that,
Right.
The door is still open there, but
right.
I would say at least, I mean, not to sort of pat ourselves on the back, but at the very least, we're actually devoted to higher ideals outside of ourselves. I mean, we're concerned about the fate of our people and our civilization. And I don't want to make it seem like, oh, I'm putting that on the same level, but you know, at least we're all not, just wrapped up in,
we're not just playing video games.
Yeah. Right.
exactly. The whole sex bot thing, you know, people are talking about these sex robots and things like that. That is just chilling to me, right? Basically, I would feel so utterly degraded and lonely if I were reduced to something like that. You know, the mind rebels against it, or your sense of pride, I would think, rebels against it, but not some people's pride. It looks like it's going to become a big industry someday. So maybe it already has become one.
Well, the scenes between Kay and I forget her name, but you know, his quote unquote wife.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I actually found them a bit difficult to watch. I mean, not in the sense of that it was poorly done. Quite the opposite. But
it was very well done. Yeah.
It was disturbing because you realize that, you know, he's actually just alone in a room with a hologram.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's basically just a more advanced version of computer porn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly.
So, yeah, I mean, that's why, I mean, I noticed in the audience when Love finally smashes her towards the end and you realize she's gone forever. You know, I heard a few, especially the women in the audience around me, kind of go like, oh, you know, but I mean, I think you're supposed to see that as a positive thing because he kind of, the umbilical cord is cut.
Right.
So now Kay is sort of free to, you know, re-enter the real world, as it were.
I mean, the downward arc is so shocking. First, there was just sex where, you know, sex was scarce and people would have to make promises and commitments to secure it regularly for themselves. And since they couldn't prevent conception and birth, oftentimes we had kids. That was the norm. Then when it became possible for people to separate sex and reproduction, sex became a consumer item, but it was at least pursued with other people. It was ultimately selfish and transitory and not the basis of lasting relationships, because relationships just built on sex don't last, but relationships where you have a family are much more stable. Eventually, you know, you just decline into a situation where there are no relationships, they're just sex, and you're very, very selfish. But then the next phase is just to eliminate the other person altogether. The porn world, the masturbation world, the sex bot world, the hologram world that they're living in here. And of course, the human race is going to die unless somebody like Niander Wallace finds a way of getting the robots to reproduce. You know, basically, it is a true dystopia that follows the downward arc of the society that we're in today. And I can't imagine that anybody writing this script can fundamentally approve of the downward arc of society today. There's something very anti-modernist and, dare I say it, reactionary about this movie.
Well, and that goes back to Philip K. Dick. I mean, you know, he certainly, even though he operated in the genre of science fiction, I mean, he was certainly not uncritical of modernity. I mean, he often used his work to, I wouldn't call him a traditionalist or somebody who was anti-modern, but he also recognized the flaws in the modern world and often used his work to explore those. I mean, actually, something that a lot of people were wondering before the film came out, if they might try to draw more on the original book, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep by Dick, because the original Blade Runner really, except for the basic concept and some of the characters, actually bears very little resemblance to the book. They didn't really go down that road in 2049. I didn't see anything especially drawn from Do Androids Dream. But one thing that did strike me is the character of Love.
Mm-hmm.
She reminds, like in the original Blade Runner, all the replicants are basically sympathetic characters to a greater or lesser extent as they're portrayed. She's the first replicant who actually is a bad guy. And she reminded me a lot of the replicants in Dick's original book, because this was actually, you know, Dick died during the production of the original Blade Runner, but he had conversations with Ridley Scott about the direction of the film. And apparently they actually argued over the nature of the replicants, because, you know, Dick basically saw the replicants as an abomination against nature, that it was impossible for them to ever become fully human, and that it was actually a good thing when Deckard wiped them out. Whereas, of course, Ridley Scott elected to make them the heroes of the story. But in the original book, you know, the replicants are shown as very detached from human emotions. They're kind of coldly, brutally violent.
They're sociopathic. They
right.
lack empathy.
That's love test. In the film.
Yeah. The Voight-Kampff test is supposed to determine empathy to responses to see if you're dealing with a replicant or a human. And it doesn't actually make any sense in the context of the Ridley Scott movie, because what differentiates replicants from humans there is not the ability to have empathy. And in fact, at the end, we see that Rutger Hauer's character, Roy Batty, does have empathy, right? And it's clear that he has empathy, that they have empathy for one another, that they are drawn together by bonds of affection, clearly. What differentiates them in the movie is the memory issue, the lack of memories, and therefore the need for fake memories or their desire to create their own memories. That differentiates them from the rest of us. But for Philip K. Dick, it is their lack of empathy. They're a race of sociopaths, and they have to be destroyed. They simply have to be destroyed. And you're right, Love really is that kind of sociopath. So that is one thing that reminds me, at least, of the original novel. That, and there's the great blackout, which sort of reminds me of World War T, the sort of great break in history that's in the background of the Dick novel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Actually, you can help me out with something. The scene where Ryan Gosling, or Kay, goes to that Somalian guy to find out where Deckard is hiding. Mm-hmm. They have a conversation in Somalian, and because I saw it here in Budapest, the subtitles were only in Hungarian, so I have no idea what he actually told him, but did he explain about what had happened to Las Vegas, or I wasn't sure what that conversation was about.
I don't remember, honestly.
Gosling says something about a dirty bomb.
Oh, yes, that's the case. The wood, apparently, he said, came from some place where the radiation levels were high, or something like that. That's how he determined Las Vegas as a location.
So something happened to Las Vegas to make it radio. I guess that implies it got nuked somehow by a terrorist or something.
Yeah.
That was another weird detail. Do you remember there's one scene where Kay is walking down the street in Los Angeles and he passes a hologram of a ballet dancer and it says something like from CCCCP.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if that was supposed to be, you know, like a retro thing or if that was implying that the Soviet Union is still around in that world, if it's some sort of alternative history.
That's an interesting question. I just took it as a retro type thing, like the Bolshoi ballet, you know?
Yeah, possibly.
Something like that.
But yeah, that was an interesting moment. But yeah, you never get to entirely find out what happened, which is, you know, I kind of like films that do that, where everything is spoon-fed to you.
Yeah, I don't mind that at all. I thought visually it was a very, very impressive film. It kept my attention. It was 2 hours and 43 minutes long, and I was not looking at my watch, so that says something. Ultimately, though, I kind of felt like the experience was hollow. It just it didn't really have the emotional payoff I was looking for, I was hoping for. But it was really intriguing and building towards something. I think it sort of swerved off track when it got to Las Vegas, and you had basically Harrison Ford doing his two-fisted, hard-drinking, scene-chewing thing. And he's not a great actor. He's not that great an actor. And I just thought that he detracted from the movie. I really wish that they had brought him in, gave him a huge check for a scene sort of like Yoda in The Return of the Jedi, where in the middle of the movie, the questing knight goes and gets an essential piece of information, and then the guy dies and that's it. That would have been good. And then everything focused back on Kay for the last act. I think that would have been much more satisfying to me.
Actually, my friend Brian Alexander, who has a blog, he wrote a review of Blade Runner, and he had an interesting interpretation of that last scene. Well, not the last one, but near the end, where Deckard is trapped in the hovercraft, or whatever you want to call it, that's slowly slipping underwater while Kay and Love are fighting. Mm-hmm. And he says, oh, you have the two sort of millennials fighting it out, and you have the boomer, like, off in the corner who is completely helpless. He can't do anything. But if he dies, it somehow means a disaster. I thought that was an interesting reading of that scene. He also pointed out something that I never would have picked up on because I haven't read this book, but when Kay goes for what they call baseline, and he's asked to recite these kind of strange lines of dialogue.
Yeah, that was weird. What was going on
there? Those are
actually
quotes from Nabokov's novel, Pale Fire.
Huh.
It's apparently a poem that's within the book, which they, in Kay's apartment, you actually see it. So I don't have anything more to say about it. I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
I haven't read the book, so I can't say what that might mean in terms of if there's some kind of reference there that's important to the meaning of the film or what. But
that'd be interesting to find out, definitely. I definitely will see the movie again. I might see it in a theater. I might just wait until I can get it on Blu-ray or something. But I will see it again. I think the director, I'm forgetting his name, Denis Villeneuve, French-Canadian guy, is a really talented director. And I don't think this was in any way a misstep. I think this was a huge break for him in a way. as a director, because he's been doing small films that have been well received for some time now. And this could have been his blockbuster film. And it doesn't quite do that. It doesn't quite rise to that level, unfortunately. I really wish somebody like Christopher Nolan got his mitts on this. It would have been something else. Nolan is really strong because he gets really strong scripts. I think he might have doctored this script up in far more interesting ways than the script that we have shot here. But in terms of just the visual style of it, I thought it was extremely well done. And I thought the pacing of it was appealing to me. It was not really fast cutting and stuff like that for the most part, which I find tiresome. I wonder, do you think the movie was less violent than the original movie? It came across to me as less violent than the original Blade Runner, which I thought was interesting too, if that's correct.
Well, there's certainly no scene comparable to the infamous death of Tyrell scene where his eyes pushed in.
Yeah, yeah.
That's still like that. A difficult scene to watch even today.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think it's a lot less violent. There are several fights, but it's not as violent a film, frankly, which sort of surprised me.
Well, it seemed like, a number of people have pointed this out, but it's more of an ambient film. It's almost like the atmosphere and the mood is almost more important than the story.
Right.
Maybe it didn't lend itself to that sort of dramatic. Well, I guess you could say maybe they're living in a world where just nothing very interesting like that happens much anymore. I don't know.
Right.
Right. It's part of this sort of soullessness of the place, perhaps.
Right. Well, are there any final thoughts on this, Mike?
Well, there was some violence. I mean, I thought Love orchestrating some of these aircraft strikes on the population of humans that were living on the outskirts was kind of violent. But yeah, I guess there wasn't as much one-on-one.
Well, there was a fight with the replicant played by that very big guy. I forget his name at the very beginning. Then there was a fight with Harrison Ford. And then there was a fight with Love at the end. And there was the attack of those garbage scavenger types.
Yeah.
And they were like killed by a drone by Love while she was getting her nails done, which I thought was kind of amusing scene.
Right.
Stylishly done. Any other thoughts, guys?
Well, I'm sure we could probably get a whole nother podcast out of it, but I don't have anything at the moment.
Yeah, I think it's a ultimately sort of empty film experience for me, but still one that I think about and want to talk about, and I will definitely see again. I think maybe some of my negative reactions to it are simply the curse of it being a sequel to such a great film, and I do think that Blade Runner is one of the classics, really, of science fiction, just period. It's a sci-fi classic. It's a truly great movie, and it's hard work to make a sequel to something like that. Given the high bar, I think everyone was destined to be somewhat disappointed with this. And maybe it's going to be a while before I can appreciate it in its own terms. But there's a lot to this film, and I do think it's worth revisiting.
Well, I think we can say the original Blade Runner was one of those types of films that really didn't need a sequel, but Hollywood is so in love with the idea these days that I guess it was almost inevitable.
Right.
I'm really wondering if they're going to try to continue this as a series.
I hope not.
Me too.
Yeah.
They probably won't because I guess it's been a big failure at the box office, so that'll probably discourage them from making more, but you never know.
Yeah. Well, guys, let's talk about your visit to Belgium recently. What was going on there? And can you give me some of your impressions of, the people, the scene, and the larger implications for our movement? John, you were the speaker. Do you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. Well, I was invited by some guys I'd known. I've spoken a couple of times to the group NSV, which is a Flemish regionalist student group in Flanders. But they have a much broader vision than just Flemish politics. They engage with traditionalism and geopolitics and the New Right and all sorts of different things, the identitarian movement. But this wasn't actually an NSV event, but some of the guys involved in organizing it were people I'd known from NSV. And this was actually a group called the May 6 Committee, which refers to the official day of the martyrs in Syria and Lebanon. It's not an Islamic holiday. It's actually a holiday to commemorate Arab nationalist martyrs. So it's not specific to any particular religion. It apparently refers to some people who were executed back during the First World War, who were Arab nationalists. But the event was organized and took place in Breda in the Netherlands. And we got there on, it took place 2 weeks ago on a Saturday. And, unfortunately it was horrible weather that day. It was raining. So when we got there, we decided not to do the speeches there. It was only Ruben, who was one of the organizers, who gave a brief speech. But otherwise we just, everyone stood there with some Syrian flags and some photos of Syrians and Russians and Iranians who've been killed in the war in Syria over the last few years. And the event was specifically designed to commemorate those people who've died fighting against ISIS and the other rebel groups in Syria over the last 7 years. So, you know, that was something, you know, I was all in favor of supporting, because we, as part of the new right, we favor nationalism for all peoples. And certainly the fighting that's been going on in Syria hasn't only had implications for the Middle East, but for everybody, since it's against ISIS and, of course, also the forces behind ISIS. So there was some video shot and some photos taken, and I understand that the video was shown on Syrian TV. I don't actually know that for sure, but I was told that that's what was going to happen. And I would say about half of the people there were European nationalists. We had people from, of course, from Belgium, but also from the Netherlands, from Serbia, from Spain, from Germany. Of course, Mike and I were both there, so America was represented. I don't think I'm leaving anybody out, although Mike can correct me if I'm forgetting any of the nationalities. And there were also some people there from the local Syrian and Iraqi communities who were active in nationalist circles there. So, you know, it was a pretty broad mix, you know, representing nationalists from many different countries. I thought that that was good. And then after the event was over, we went back into Belgium, and there's a fellow named Chris Roman. He's Flemish, but he runs an organization called Euro-Rus, which is an organization he founded sort of dedicated to trying to bring Western Europeans and Russians closer together. And he has a sort of facility at his home that he uses for events, and we held the speeches there. And that's actually where I delivered my speech on the implications of the Syrian war, which I put up at Countercurrents a week ago, so it's there if anyone's interested. And some other talks were given by some of the other nationalists, specifically on secessionism, like the gentleman from Spain who was there gave a talk on the Catalonian referendum, which was very interesting. He was very much against independence. I think the video has been put up online if you're curious to know what he said. There was also one of the Serbs gave a talk on Kosovo. Chris Roman himself talked a bit about Ukraine and, you know, some of the other separatist movements in the former Soviet territories. Oh, I should also mention, of course, that our friend Gergo from Hungary, who's one of the leaders of the Hungarian branch of Generation Identity, he was present and he gave a talk on the situation in Hungary, specifically in relation to the EU and the migrant crisis and so forth. So it was a pretty broad mix, and I think everyone agreed that it was a very interesting and broad reaching event in terms of, you know, where everyone was from. I certainly met a lot of interesting people. So, I thought it was a very successful event overall. Mike, what were your impressions?
I thought it was a really broad slice of European nationalists who were represented there. It was quite interesting. You know, I didn't know really what to expect going into it. I knew it was going to be a show of unity and support among Europeans for what's going on in Syria, for the Syrian government and their fight against ISIS. It was interesting to hear some of the talks and discuss the situation in Catalonia and have a conversation about independence movements generally. And
I feel I should mention, too, it's not just ISIS either, but the other rebel groups are just as problematic. Like, there's that famous video, kind of difficult to watch, of that one rebel leader who ripped the heart out of the body of one of the Syrian soldiers who was killed in the fighting and ate it on camera, who it turned out was somebody who was in the pay of the CIA and was actually filmed around the same time standing next to John McCain. So I don't think there are really many good guys among the rebels over there. I think we can safely say that Assad staying in power was definitely the best option under the circumstances.
Yes, definitely.
Well, we've been going on for about an hour now. I think this has been a very good conversation. And so I think we should basically wrap up here. Are there any last thoughts, John?
No, I think we basically covered everything we wanted to talk about. I definitely think we should, Greg, you're probably separate from the weekly podcast. We should go back to doing movie discussions again, because I really like those.
Yeah, I agree. I've been doing a lot more thinking and writing recently about movies. I did this piece on Rashomon recently that I've been germinating for a while.
And oh, that was really good. I like that.
I'm glad you like that. Yeah, I'm going to actually watch all 30 movies that Kurosawa directed. I'd only seen about 12 of them over the years, and so there are 18 Kurosawa films I haven't seen yet, and I need to work through those, and I also want to go back through his old ones that I have seen before and write more about him. And I'm also going to be writing more about David Lynch, too, because he's one of my favorite directors up there with Kurosawa. And I do want to work up into doing something about the new Twin Peaks series. I'm going to have to rewatch that. But before I do that, I want to do some other stuff dealing with Lynch and some other stuff dealing with Kurosawa. Then, of course, there are all these other directors that you and I share an interest in. So, yeah, I think it would add to my pleasure, my viewing pleasure. And I think also to our listeners' pleasure, because I think these film podcasts do have a following of their own. So, yeah, let's definitely do more of that.
Sure.
Mike, is there anything else you'd like to say in wrapping up?
No, I think we pretty much covered everything.
Well, great. Well, this has been a good conversation, and we will be back in a week's time with another episode of Countercurrents Radio.
See you next week, everybody.
Bye-bye.